This is part four of Your Life is Their Toy, Merchants of Medicine, by Emanuel Josephson from 1948. Serf versus Overlord. The position of the rank and file of the profession contrasts sharply with that of the medical merchant, quote-unquote, leader or boss. Their position is that of serfs, puppets, and stooges of the medical social service rackets. They are ludicrously pathetic figures, befuddled, and often not of the highest mental caliber. From the moment they enter pre-medical training, they are caught between two millstones, the social service rackets and the treacherously racketeering medical organizations. As they advance, they are progressively ground down to a condition which eventually leaves them devoid of initiative and thinking capacity and makes them the stupidly helpless pawns of the two super rackets which they are coerced to join and support. In doing so, they destroy their livelihood and crush themselves. There are a few isolated cases of physicians who cherish and preserve principles and ideals in spite of terrific economic and political pressure placed on them. They are called, quote-unquote, insurgents, and are regarded with suspicion by their confreres as being mentally unsound. But the rarest thing in the annals of history is the physician who is reckless and foolhardy enough to risk his reputation and livelihood in the attempt to clean the Augean stable of medical politics, organization, and racketeering. Such prodigies are editorially attacked by the quote-unquote boss himself in the columns of the Journal of the AMA as horrible examples, as was I in April 1930. With rare exceptions, physicians follow the path of least resistance, even though it leads to self-destruction. They find themselves in the status of mere men seeking to eke out an existence by caring for the ills and catering to the caprices of mankind. They are no more honest than the rank and file of mankind. They succumb to pressure and temptation, and accept the tenets of the selfsame rackets which destroy them. With few exceptions, they cherish in their bosoms the almost forlorn hope that they may rise some day to the racketeering heights of medical bosses and merchants in medicine, and thereby win fame and fortune. But the hope of winning even fortune is for a great majority of them utterly vain, for the physician's stock in trade is the faith of the patient in the falsely assumed ability of the doctor to quote-unquote cure. In reality, no doctor quote-unquote cures any disease. The patient cures himself. The physician can only help in the process by making conditions for recovery favorable and by avoiding damaging interference with nature's workings. To do this, he must at times pretend to wisdom and knowledge when his ignorance is most abysmal, and in these moments he is at best a benevolent confidence man. His chief stock in trade is the patient's confidence in him. But this confidence has been destroyed by the medical and social service rackets. The medical serf has been severely handicapped by his lords and masters. Meager earnings. There has never been refuted intelligently the myth that the average member of the medical profession is responsible for the, quote, high cost of medical care, unquote. While it is true that the medical, quote-unquote, leaders are unconscionably exorbitant in their charges, the fee scale of the average physician is absurdly low and often less than the charges of pay clinics. The fees of the average physician today are no higher than they were 100 to 150 years ago. The 1817 fee bill of the Boston Medical Association and that of New York in 1790 showed charges of $2 to $5 per initial visit. Consultations were $5 for the first visit and $3 for subsequent visits. Night visits were $5. The scale of the workman's compensation insurance fee schedule, recently adopted by the Medical Society of the State of New York, differs slightly from those of 1790. The charge allowed for the first visit, including the filling out of numerous forms and testimony before the compensation referee, is $5. Under the 1790 New York fee bill, the charge for filling the forms alone would be $10 to $15. The charge for a night visit in 1790 was $5. The present schedule allows $4. Incision of an abscess cost the same in 1790 as today, $5. The charges for amputation at the shoulder, $150, has not risen since 1790. Some of the charges made in 1790 were slightly higher than those of today, and vice versa. It should be borne in mind, however, that in those days, a dozen eggs could be had for a few cents. This makes it apparent how much the cost of medical services has dropped in the past century and a half, in spite of tremendously greater costs of rendering those services. Low wage scale. The average physician who seeks part or full-time employment is no more fortunate financially than he who seeks to eke out an existence in private practice. He finds that the wage scale for doctors is lower than that of most forms of unskilled labor. Especially is this true in public service. The scale of salaries of physicians in public service is probably highest in New York City. Few of the world-renowned physicians who have made life safe for the citizens of New York, at the risk of their own health and lives, earn, after many years of service, the $18 a day of the asbestos worker, or the $20 a day of the skilled tool maker. The average pay of doctors working on a part-time basis for the Health Department of New York City is $1.60 per hour. This rate has had the approval of the New York County Medical Society. As has been related, the Society has suggested that doctors employed by the city, especially those in the Health Department, shall be deprived of civil service protection and of all rights and privileges, including sick leave, vacation, and pension, which are given to all other municipal workers. The society is completely controlled by the henchmen of organized social service and has adopted as its goal the destruction of the livelihoods of its less affluent and less influential members. Relief and unionization. The Philadelphia County Assistance Board, a social service agency, set the following hour wage scale in 1939. Bricklayers, $1.62. Plasterers, $1.55. And doctors, $1.51. The medical profession has contributed heavily to swelling relief rolls. Approximately a third of New York's doctors were still on relief in 1937. Employed physicians have sought the aid of social service and of labor unions in the attempt to gain an adequate wage. The AFL has always turned them down on the basis of the convenient myth that doctors, even though employed as workers, are capital bourgeois and independent entrepreneurs. The truth of the matter is that labor employs doctors and prefers to be free to take advantage of them without qualms. Also, labor has espoused the cause of its fellow travelers, the social service rackets that seek to prey on medicine. Under the terms of the Wagner Act, some groups of physicians have organized under the CIO, but their position has not been improved materially thereby. The derogatory attitude of labor towards the medical profession has become accentuated. Education costs versus earnings. The wage of the doctor contrasts sharply with high and ever-mounting cost of a medical education and of keeping abreast of changing methods and of advances in medicine. It is a curious fact that the more richly medical education becomes endowed, the costlier does it become to the student. It now involves study over a period of 20 to 25 years and an average cost of between $20,000 and $25,000. The average work life of the physician is about 30 years. It can easily be calculated that to earn the costs of his education alone, the doctor would have to make about $1,500 a year. To earn a bare living, plus the cost of maintenance of his office, the physician must make $5,000 a year. In order to keep abreast of medical advance and be a competent physician, and at the same time live comfortably, the physician must earn between $7,000 and $10,000 a year. It is doubtful if more than 10% of the medical profession of this country earn this last figure. It is questionable whether one out of four doctors now makes enough to amortize the cost of his education alone. In most cases now, the study of medicine involves a large economic loss. Licensing racket. This does not imply that there is an excessive number of physicians in the country. Many parts of the country have not sufficient physicians, and few sections of the country have too many physicians for adequate medical care of the public. But each state in the Union licenses its citizen physicians and shuts out physicians licensed by other states. This often bars the way to adequate medical services to their communities. The situation today is much the same as it was in 1846, when the state medical societies directly controlled the licensing of physicians and used their powers to create medical monopolies. Curiously enough, some states permit free entry to foreign physicians while barring entry of Americans. Social service costs versus medical. The average earnings of a physician in the height of prosperity, 1928 and 1929, were less than those of skilled laborers. At that time, in the midst of boom and prosperity, over 60% of the populace requiring medical treatment in our larger cities were receiving it from hospitals and clinics gratis, or at a low figure per unit of service. During the years of depression, the persons receiving such services rose to almost 90% of the populace of the country requiring medical aid. This does not mean that the cost of illness to the public is low. It is relatively high, but only a small fraction of it is paid to physicians. The bulk of the community's medical expenditures go to the purses of the social service rackets. Large fractions go to hospitals and nurses, and least to the doctors. The Welfare Council of New York City estimated in Prosperous 1928 that there were 40,000 paid workers engaged in social service work in New York. Their salaries amounted to approximately $75 million. All of this money had been donated by charitable persons in the community for the care of the poor. If only half of this money that is diverted by social service workers into their pockets were used for the payment of physicians for the care of the ailing poor, the caliber of services could be materially improved, and doctors would receive about $3,000 a year for their work. Money expended in this manner would more truly serve the purpose for which the funds were donated than its present use. Surf pathetic. The pathos of the plight of the medical profession is accentuated and set in comic relief by the obvious absurdity of its sense of helplessness. Physicians cannot be replaced overnight. Properly organized to protect their interests, the medical profession could command a fair treatment and an adequate wage from the community. But organized medicine has joined the social service rackets in betraying its ranks and has aided the impoverishment and debasement of its own members. It has coerced the physician to aid in robbing himself of both his livelihood and of the respect of the community. So awed is the medical serf by the boss merchants that he does not dream of asserting himself and fighting for his existence. Instead, he slinks after treacherously corrupt, quote-unquote, leaders. The force by which he is held is the growing power of organized medicine and its control of hospitals and of medical licensure. The character of the licensing boards is indicated by the recent indictment in New York of an assistant attorney general who was assigned to collaborate with the Medical Board of Regents on the charge of complicity in quote-unquote fixing for an abortion racket, and by the anxiety-caused death of his associate, an AMA-affiliated secretary of the board, Dr. Harold Ripens, who was also accused. Discipline of the racket. To incur the enmity of the American Medical Association or its local state or county society means to run the risk of loss of livelihood. Organized medicine figuratively grips the throat of every physician. To avoid deliberately and maliciously circulated slander on his competence, the medical serf must toe the mark in the regime prescribed for him by medical bosses. As in any racket, to obey means quote-unquote protection, and failure to conform means to court disaster. Illustrative of the methods employed is my own experience. In 1931, I resigned from the New York County Medical Society and the AMA because I objected to racketeering of the organizations. Thereafter, my scientific discoveries were barred from publication. Rumors damaging to my reputation were circulated. Scientific societies were urged to bar my participation in their proceedings. My works and I were libeled in publications of the AMA, and replies were barred. In 1937, a colleague, Dr. Guernsey Fry, attempted to bar my participation in a scientific discussion in a New York Academy of Medicine meeting on the ground that my resignation from the AMA and my failure to pay tribute and dues to it made me a physician, quote, not in good standing, unquote. The allegation was widely broadcast in an effort to injure my reputation and practice by slander. In the attempt to subordinate science to medical politics, there shines forth the blind stupidity of the medical dimwits. Their attitude resembles more closely that of the ostrich that seeks to avert danger by burying its head in the sand. How serious may be the consequences to a physician of disciplinary action of organized medicine is indicated by the case of Dr. W. W. Robinson. A court ordered the Spokane County Medical Society to pay him $30,000 for, quote, slandering and humiliating him, unquote. Group Health Association Incorporated. The Group Health Association Incorporated and the government's indictment has brought to the attention of the nation some of the less vicious methods that the American Medical Association uses in enforcing its discipline and protecting the business of its bosses. This situation has arisen primarily out of the struggle between the organized social service and organized medicine for the control of the medical rackets. The indictment charges the American Medical Association, its local subsidiary, and the Washington hospitals with conspiring to coerce and intimidate doctors and consultants to refuse to serve the Group Health Association and to blacklist and boycott doctors employed by it, with the object of preventing competition. In the following pages will be related activities of the AMA, which are far more vicious and dangerous to the public, which Assistant Attorney General Thurman Arnold refuses to include in the indictment. These activities do not merely jeopardize the purses of the public and of the social service cliques, but menace the health and lives of the public. An indictment based on such charges would not have been dismissed by the courts. For many of them are quite clearly conspiracy in restraint of trade and designed to create monopolies. It is probable, however, that the courts will eventually sustain the indictment as it stands. This concludes part 4 of Your Life is Their Toy, Merchants and Medicine by Emmanuel Josephson from 1948.